introduce one of our speakers and one of our first speakers, and I have the pleasure to introduce Dr. Peter Anglin. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background information on all the physicians so that you know who they are and where they came from. Peter obtained his medical degree from Queens in Kingston, and then did a clinical fellowship in internal medicine, hematology, and oncology. He's been practicing for the last 15 years in the Greater Toronto Area and is currently a staff hematologist, medical oncologist, and head of the medical oncology department in Newmarket, Ontario, at the Stronach Regional Cancer Centre at Southlake. Dr. Anglin's clinical focus has been in hematological and lymphoid malignancies, and he also pursued an MBA from the Rotman School of Management at U of T, as he's developed an interest in both healthcare delivery systems and also process design in the clinical ambulatory setting. So I would like to introduce Peter, Dr. Anglin. Thank you, Peter.
Is there a pointer?
They were going to get a pointer.
If there was a pointer, that would work. If we don't have one, that's fine. Good morning. I'll start and see. Good morning. Thank you for asking me to speak. And, you know, I've spoken at these kind of events over the years, and I always enjoy them because we always enjoy speaking to an interested and captivated crowd, and you've got a real interest in this entity. So it's always a pleasure to speak for a while at events like this. I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes. I'm going to give you an overview, which will be a springboard for the other speakers who will delve into the more specifics of different lymphomas. So with no further ado, this is such a stupid slide, I show it. I mean, I'll say no more, and I'll go on. Like, I've had it forever. historical background. In 1666, there was a description in what appears to be, is that Latin? Or it's probably Latin. A Latin publication in the mid-17th century. And then in 1832, Dr. Hodgkin is someone that you often see a picture of because he looks so distinguished there, and it's one of those pictures that seems to come up a lot. But he wrote a paper in 1832 called On Some Morbid Appearances of the Absorbent Glands and Spleen. So there's some history for you of lymphoma. What I'm going to talk about today, I've given you, that's the history. I'm going to give you just a few statistics. And then I'm going to talk just about the upfront diagnostic process, how we make some upfront decisions and sort you out. And then the rest of the speakers are going to get into the details of what they do about the specific entities. Well, you just heard, this is Cancer Care Ontario statistics, but for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, there's been a rising incidence for many decades. But what's interesting is the pattern does seem to be changing, and the incidence is starting to decrease. I will just distinguish, incidence is cases per 100,000. So the actual number of cases in Ontario increases because our population is bigger. But the actual frequency per 100,000 people is starting to level off for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, mostly because in younger people there may be less incidence. That could relate to a lot of things like control of HIV and things, but we're not quite sure why. In Ontario, there were about 3,000 cases, which translates to 9,000 cases nationally. And in 2032, so 20 years from now, that'll likely be 4,500 cases. So that's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the biggest risk factor for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is age. And that is that's a paradigm really for most malignancies. The longer we live, the more chance there is for aberrant changes in our DNA, which controls cellular growth. And hence, as you get older, you tend to see more non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. Lastly, just Hodgkin's disease is a little bit different. It's about one-fifth the incidence of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And even in medical school, I'm scared to say, but 25 years ago, they talked about a bimodal peak. So young people, late teens, early 20s can get this disease. And you don't see a lot of middle-aged people with it, and then it comes up again when you're 60 or 70 years old. And that's quite typical for what we see in practice. So, but in the middle-aged area, there's a lower incidence of Hodgkin's lymphoma. So in Ontario this year, there would be about 600 cases of Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is my only slide on classification, and it's just, as Sue said, there are many, I don't know how many types of lymphoma there are either. You know, some would say around 60. The classification continues to evolve. About 90% of lymphomas are B-cell, and about 10% are the group of T-cell lymphomas. Hodgkin's disease, as I mentioned, is a separate entity of which there are three or four subtypes as well. I'll emphasize the diagnostic procedure and how important it is to pin down the specific type of lymphoma, because that allows us to pick the best treatment algorithm for you. This is one slide to show you why are there so many different types of lymphoma. It's because when the lymphoid cells develop and are stimulated and go through different phases of maturation, at any time a certain cell can peel off and become malignant. And that's probably the simplest way to think of it. So you see a stem cell, which is a starter for what forms lymphoid cells. And going down that slide, each one of those is a lymphocyte that's developing and becoming more mature. And at any time, you can have the cell can all of a sudden will say, I'm going to be cancerous and start growing in a somewhat uncontrolled way. And that's why you end up on the right side with a bunch of different lymphoid malignancies. So just to give you an idea and flavor of why lymphoma can be many different diseases. And this is a slide that most of you, you're all interested in lymphoma, so you've probably seen variants or permutations of this slide many different places. But this just shows the main types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that's around. Diffuse large B-cell lymphoma makes up about a third of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. It's a very common entity that we hear about. You'll be hearing about that in more detail from our other speakers. In addition to that, follicular lymphoma makes up about a quarter or so. That's the second, that's the purple one beside the light blue. And then from there on, there's a variety of other low-grade lymphomas, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and then we get into many other subtypes. But you know, between large cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, and two or three more common low-grade lymphomas, quickly we're up to about two-thirds to 70% of all the lymphomas. And then you've got this other catch bag of about 30% of lymphomas that has about 40 other different entities. So it's an interesting sphere that we practice in, that you have fairly common things, and then you've got a lot of not so common things that you want to be specific at sorting out, so again, you can deliver the best therapy to people. I'd mentioned, this is just to remind me to tell you then that Hodgkin's lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, the Hodgkin's disease or lymphomas we say is about a fifth of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. That's the diagnostic cell of Hodgkin's lymphoma called the Reed-Sternberg cell, and it looks like an owl's eyes. You see those two big, that big cell in the middle, and it looks like it's eyes there. That's called a Reed-Sternberg cell, and that's the kind of thing that pathologists look at when they're looking under the microscope to make specific lymphoma diagnoses. Let's talk about how people present. I want to thank Sue for showing that video. That was really something. And I mean, in fact, the first thing I wanted to say, that's a very tough act to follow. And I'm not a rock star by any means. But what you heard in that is that one, you know, often this disease presents as a little lump that people become aware of and they go to their physician. That's probably the most common presentation that we see. But it can present in a variable fashion. Some people can get very ill over a couple of weeks and they start getting night sweats and lose their appetite, and it's a flu that doesn't go away. It can evolve over weeks to months. And again, you hear about people, they've had 1 or 2 years of a node and they finally get it checked out and it ends up being a lymphoma. Night sweats and fevers and weight loss are something that people can describe when they have generally more advanced lymphoma. And then, of course, the local manifestations, including the enlarged lymph nodes, is the most common. There are a whole variety of other things that lymphomas can do, and this tends to be when they get larger and more advanced in most cases, but they can infiltrate the bone marrow and you can get low blood counts, and that makes you tired. It can infiltrate the central nervous system and give you symptoms of nerve problems and weakness in the arms and the legs. It can cause autoimmune phenomenon where you produce antibodies to other red cells and platelets, and again, low blood counts. And what importantly it can do, some lymphomas can be quite aggressive, grow quickly, and press on critical structures. So a large abdominal mass or something might press on the kidney and create problems. And then you can collect fluid in the chest or the abdomen. So this tends to be in patients that have more advanced disease, both in the low-grade and more aggressive histology-type lymphomas. So you can be perfectly well for a year with a little lymph node, or you can get really sick over 2 weeks and go to the doctor, say something's really wrong, and then everything in between. And one of the, just a note about the persistent lymph node, you know, the fact that we're alive means lymph nodes go up and down. And so small lymph nodes, the right thing to do generally with a small lymph node is not to jump on and biopsy every lymph node. But generally what we do say is if you have something persistent for 2 or 3 months and it's 1.5 to 2 centimeters, so it's approaching an inch and it's not going away, that's something that sometimes we take note of. And that's in the context of other things that might be going on, if you've got an active infection, that kind of thing. So, you know, one other line that I share with people is the retrospectoscope's always 20/20. And so sometimes sorting out things isn't as straightforward. There's the medical disclaimer for small lymph nodes anyhow. The most important thing we do with lymphoma is get a biopsy to figure out what specific type of lymphoma you have. And this is an example of someone had an enlarged lymph node in the neck and they have a surgical procedure, and that's what the chunk of tissue that comes out of the neck looks like. The next thing that we do is we put it under the microscope. We don't. You wouldn't want. We get special hematopathologists who do this every day, looking at this under the microscope to start sorting out what kind of, firstly, is it cancer, yes or no? Then is it lymphoma, yes or no? Then what kind of lymphoma it is? And we do a whole variety of things. Different lymphomas have different proteins on their surface, and that helps us distinguish what kind of lymphoma you have. And those greenish-blue things are antibodies to different cell surface markers that help us determine what kind of lymphoma you have. So we end up putting stains on that. We can start saying that this lymphoma over here expresses CD20, which is the name of a protein, and this one expresses BCL2. So when we look at all of this, we can say this is by how it looks under the microscope and these stains, we can say that is follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that's a start. And that gets us there. This kind of stuff gets us there 90% of the time. But there are other things that we do. We can do some other special tests to look at the proteins on the cells to help sort the lymphoma out. And there's something called flow cytometry, which again helps us determine what the proteins are on the cell to distinguish the particular lymphoma. We can do some more fancy tests where we look at the DNA and we use something called FISH, which is fluorescent in situ hybridization. But basically, this is a probe that looks at DNA. And it can identify specific DNA aberrations that are characteristic to specific lymphomas. In this case, something called mantle cell lymphoma. And so again, these are all, and these tools, this is largely an Ontario audience I think I'm speaking to. So you would have, 99% of you should have access when you seek medical attention, biopsies, and further testing to these kind of diagnostic tests. That's not for you to, it's our responsibility to make sure those things happen. And then just a note about where we're going with diagnostics in the future is, again, understanding the DNA, which is the control box for tumors and cells. And we're starting to look at the genes that are expressed in different tumors in much more detail. For example, on the left, that's someone with large cell lymphoma, and what they're able to do is to look at the expression of 57 different genes. A gene is a piece of a chromosome that codes for a protein, and proteins are what you need to make your cells work. And so this looks if the gene is working, yes, it's on or not, and then you can form what we call a signature and then get patterns and then start to say, this lymphoma is higher risk and it's not going to do well. What could we do differently? And this lymphoma looks like they're lower risk, and what might we do differently? This is not, hasn't hit prime time yet. It's exciting work. My guess is that in the next 5 years or so, we may start to see some incorporation of this kind of testing. Something like this is not freely available right now. It's still specialized to research labs. Now, to take all that of what I told you, then we frame, when we evaluate a patient with lymphoma, the most important things that we do are we sort out what the pathology is specifically. We stage the disease. I'm going to show you a couple slides on staging. And then we look at the general health of the patient. And with that, we formulate a treatment plan. You need to give treatments that patients can tolerate depending on their age, et cetera. And it's based on the prognosis for their particular lymphoma. We do a number of staging investigations that many of you are familiar with here, including blood tests, a bone marrow examination, which is generally done in the back here with a bit of freezing. And my classic line is, it's not as bad as going to the dentist and your head isn't vibrating at 100 hertz. And most bone marrow exams go pretty well, but like any test, very occasionally it can be quite painful for patients. Most of the time, patients will say it wasn't as bad as I thought. We do some imaging. I'm going to show you a couple of imaging tests that we do to help stage. And sometimes we'll do a lumbar puncture to sample the cerebral spinal fluid. These are examples of CAT scans. Many of you, in my clinic, I'm fortunate that I have computers in the patient room so I can show images to patients, because I find most people like to see, like, what are we dealing with? Get a mental image. We're going to treat it, and then let's look at the pictures afterwards. So in this particular picture on your left, that big lump in the middle there shouldn't be there like that. So that's of the abdomen. That's a CAT scan of the chest on the right. So CAT scans are very important and standard staging investigations that we perform to get a sense of the anatomic extent of the lymphoma. We do something often called a gallium scan to help us sort out where the lymphoma is, and that's complementary to the CAT scan. We do PET scans sometimes. We don't do PET scans all of the times, and I'll just give you an example. Here's an example where we combine PET scan with CT scan, and the advantage of a PET scan, it helps us determine if a lump is cancer or not. And I said helps us determine. There's often this feeling amongst the lay public, and I don't mean that in any other way in the sense that I need a PET scan because PET scans are perfect and it'll give us the answer. It's a good test. It has a role. We're using more PET scans now in Ontario to sort out lymphomas, but they're often not required at the beginning of therapy for staging. We tend to use them a lot on an interim or at the end of treatment now to try to sort out the significance of a residual mass. And again, in Ontario, that test is now available to us to use in specific circumstances. So some of you may have had experience with the PET scan, but many people with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma can be managed perfectly well without a PET scan. So I want to make the two points that that's available in Ontario for appropriate use, and we're using it now, but not everyone needs a PET scan. And this is an example of how it glows. I didn't bring a color one, but so there's a lump there, but it's glowing there. So that suggests that there might be residual lymphoma. Very often, to be sure, you have to go in and do a biopsy because other things can make a PET scan glow. It's not a 100% perfect test. And this is one example, though, of, you know, if you do get treatment for your lymphoma and then get a PET scan, you would rather have a negative PET scan than a positive PET scan, because some people who have more people with a positive PET scan will develop progressive tumors again. So this is, I think, maybe a progression-free curve where 100% of people are evaluated, and if the PET scan's negative, very few of those relapse, but if the PET scan is positive, many people come out of remission. So it's nice to have a negative PET scan. Staging of lymphomas, this is my only staging slide. We use a staging classification where we look at the number of areas involved and whether it's above or below the diaphragm and then whether it's extensive or not. So stage one is usually a single lymph node group above or below the diaphragm. Lymphoma by nature is more common above the diaphragm than below. Stage two disease is on one side of the diaphragm, you have two disparate lymph node groups. That's what we call stage 2 disease. So you see a lot of stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma, for example, above the diaphragm. Stage 3 is where you have lymph nodes above and below the diaphragm. Very common, particularly for indolent lymphomas. And lastly, stage 4 is where there is diffuse dissemination of a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that could involve, for example, in the lungs, not contiguous, but different spots, disparate in the lungs. Bone marrow, liver, those become stage 4 presentations. And there is generally a correlation between the extent of lymphoma and prognosis, generally. And that holds for most lymphomas, the indolent or low-grade lymphomas, and the aggressive, more aggressive, like large cell lymphomas. Again, you'd rather have an earlier stage. And staging always figures into prognostic classifications that we do to try to help patients sort out what's going to happen with their lymphoma. The other thing we talk about is B symptoms, which is weight loss, generally accepted 10% of your weight loss, or night sweats. And when we say night sweats, you know, if you ask 100 people if they get night sweats, about 85% will say yes. But we all sweat a little bit at the back of our neck. The night sweats that we're interested in are soaking night sweats, where it's distinctly different than what you've experienced before. You're having to change your t-shirt or whatever you wear, and your bedding is generally soaked. That's what we really push. So the specificity of that symptom, it's important to clarify, and you'll find doctors often asking real details about were they night sweats or not. Because if you have B symptoms, that is you've lost a fair amount of weight or you have soaking night sweats, that generally correlates with more advanced lymphoma. So we've put all that together. We take all the information and of the lymphoma, the extent. You've assessed the patient for their medical problems, and then you want to formulate a treatment plan and prognosis for that patient. And we do have a number of scores or prognostic scores for different types of lymphomas. And one of the first described was the International Prognostic IPI. What's the last I in IPI? Index. Thank you, Matt. The IPI for a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And that typically looks at the extent of the disease, how a patient is performing or feels, and a number of other parameters. There's 5 in all. And each one of these, there's one for low-grade lymphoma, there's one for advanced Hodgkin's lymphoma, and again, all of them incorporate extent of disease, where the tumor is, does it involve lymph nodes or not, usually some blood parameters, and then you can come up with a score that will help say, what are the chances of getting this person into remission, and what are the chances of them being free of disease in 5 years? None of these scores are perfect, but it does help shape how high risk the particular lymphoma may be for any particular patient. And importantly, a lot of these scores are specific to the specific type of lymphoma. This is probably the busiest slide that I'll show you, and this is a lead-in to my colleagues who are going to drill down to the other lymphomas. But generally, other than the low-grade non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, most other lymphomas are treated after they're sorted out and diagnosed. There is a group of patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the low-grade, where we'll just observe them, this so-called watch and wait. And generally that's for when the tumor is above and below the diaphragm, and which is the most common presentation. So we'll watch those. But most other lymphomas, including Hodgkin's disease, when we make the diagnosis, we will then formulate a treatment plan incorporating radiation or chemotherapy. This is another stupid cartoon. Stuff to do when you have cancer. Use a Nerf ball to see if your oncologist has a sense of humor. I know, it's so stupid. That's the end of my talk. I can give you guys the slide if you want to use it. Thank you for your attention. Okay.